some truths I'd like to share with you all, and hopefully you'll be blessed by it. So what I want to work through today is I got a couple topics I want to work through on fatherhood. We'll talk about what is a father, what is the purpose of fatherhood, what are the responsibilities of a father. Keep going here, agenda-wise. And then what have I learned as a father? I'm 6 years, six, nearly 7 years in here, so some things I've learned that I didn't know going in. I thought I'd share some of those insights with you all. And then lastly, what did I learn from my father? And that'll get some elements of how our relationship with God, that we are sons of God. What does that mean? And how does that, what can we learn from our physical relationship that translates to our spiritual relationships? Okay, so the way I teach, I'm very interactive. I like to talk to people. I like to get some feedback. And so I'll be asking questions. I want to get your insights and your inputs as we're going along. So I'll start. Does anyone have a general definition? What do you think a father is? What is a father? Anybody have a comment or a question? Go ahead, yeah. Sure, everyone does, yep. Okay. Okay. Well, that's good. That's definitely a biblical aspect of father. So I'm going to take down notes as we're going. We're going to see, make sure that I come back and speak to these. So I heard provider and responsible. He took care of his responsibilities. Anyone else have something that father means? When they hear the word father, is there a notion? Go ahead, sister.
To take care of a family. So my definition of a father is someone that know how to love and know how to have a family. It was 12 of us. So Whoa. My father knew how to provide. He was a good father. You know, he passed away in 2014. And at the funeral, I stood up and told everybody that could believe some of the things I was saying. But I said, my father was a protector. You know, okay. He didn't let you get away with everything. And that's the way I help father. He don't let us get away with everything that we want to get away with. So I consider my father as being a lovable, a protector, a provider. All that is good. My father did it. So
awesome.
That's what a father is.
Awesome. So again, took away from that, one who loves, one who cares, one who protects. So we got a provider, one who's responsible to their commitments, one who loves, one who cares, one who protects. Anyone else got one other comment and I'll move on? Okay. Sister, go ahead.
When I think about father, I think about my dad. He was a father to the fatherless.
Okay.
The kids in the neighborhood, they appreciated my dad as much as we did. I mean, they would come and, Mr. Willis this, Mr. Willis that, because he not only fathered us, but he had a van and he would just gather all the kids and take them to the park. So I say he was a father to the fatherless, which was great.
So one that has a heart for others. He's not just concerned about his immediate, his and his own, but one who also has a broader vision for those around. That's another good one. I saw one more comment back here, then I'll move on. Go ahead. Sorry, Josh. I got you running around the whole.
Fathers are supposed to. Man, I talk so loud. I don't need this.
Go ahead, sister. Go ahead.
My father was fun, and he was in the military also, but. My definition of fathers is a father that can discipline with love and teach you at the same time, because my father was that type of father. I used to get into all kind of trouble. So he would give me that spanking, but he would also tell you why you're getting that spanking, and then he will teach you why you're getting that spanking. And so he was very good at making us a good father to take care of the home like everyone else's father, because he was in the military and he did travel a lot, you know. And so I think that's one aspect of being a good father, to be able to discipline, but not kill your child.
There you go.
But teach your child and love your child.
That's right. That's right. So you all are hitting on everything that I'm going to get into here today. There's some biblical principles about fatherhood that I'd like to talk to you about today. And I think you guys have hit all those notes already. So I'm going to circle. We'll get to each one of these as we go. So I'm going to start the way I am, a very rigorous and thorough type of person. I like to get to the very, you know, lowest element of something, understanding it, its fundamental construction, and build it up and build on it. So I'm going to get into some of the biblical definitions of fatherhood. We have there's two words in the Bible that are translated as father, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, the word Ab. You always hear the term Abba, father. And Ab is actually, when they actually put Abba in the translation, it's meant to emphasize a term of intimacy and endearment. It's not just father, yes sir, it's daddy, daddy, father. So you have the term Abba. What does that mean in the Hebrew? It's originator, producer, generator, the begatter, the source. And you can break that down further. Biologically speaking, it's the source of something. Someone is the biological source of someone else. Either directly, you know, father, son, or indirectly in terms of a forefather. The Israelites would talk about their father Abraham. Even someone that was 20 generations removed, still Abraham was their father. Then you also have it in the creative sense, metaphorically speaking, or how can I say it? It's not even metaphorically, it's more in a non-biological sense, I'll say. You have the father of modern medicine is known as Hippocrates. You ever hear the doctors say that they have to take the Hippocratic Oath? That's based on Hippocrates. Copernicus is known as the father of astronomy. He's the one who first built the model for a sun-centered solar system. At some point, the secular scientific community thought that the sun went around the earth, even though the Bible has told us many years in Job and Psalms that that he sets the circuit of the sun through the universe, and that the earth actually goes around the sun. But when the secular world caught up, it was Copernicus who built that model. Socrates is known as the father of philosophy. So the father can also speak of someone who's the originator of an art, of a concept. In the Bible, Abraham is known as the father of faith. He's not the father of faith in the sense that he's our source of faith, but he was the one who set the model for righteousness by faith, right? He was the first one to relate to God through faith and be appointed as righteous, what we have today. Romans 4:16, it says, therefore it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, meaning not to only the Jews, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. So Paul is saying anyone who has the faith of Abraham, that same relationship to God by faith, being appointed righteous by believing and trusting in him, in a sense we are taking after our father Abraham. Also, we have Satan is known as the father of lies. In John 8:44, ye are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is the liar and the father of it. On the contrary side of that, we have God referred to in, let's see, it should be John. I put Romans here. I believe it's John 4:17. I got the wrong notes here. But every good and perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. Of his own will he begat us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creature. I believe it's John 4:17 or James. James, thank you, sir. Thank you for correcting that. So God, on the other hand, we have Satan who's the father of lies. We have God who's the father of lights, and lights being emblematic of goodness, of virtue, of positivity, of the things that are helpful and not harmful. James 1:17. Thank you for that. Okay, so another definition of father tied to the Hebrew word Abba is a term of respect and honor, meaning head or authority over a household. Someone could be a father of a household without necessarily being the biological source of everyone in the household. It's meant to speak to a place of respect, a place of authority. And then lastly, we have the word Abba applied universally to God, that God is ultimately the source of all that is, right? All that we see, all that we experience, God is the source. So he's the father of us all in that sense. In the New Testament, the Greek word for father is pater. You may hear the term patron, that someone's or patriarch. That's where we get that word from, that's where it derives from. And it basically has the same meanings as we saw in the Hebrew word Abba, but there's some two additional terms that also were added on in the Greek. One who has infused his own spirit into others, one who actuates and governs their minds. So it's speaking of also that one who not only is a biological source for an offspring, but one who also passes on aspects of his character, one who influences. You can have the people who, many people say that they didn't grow up with a father, but yet they look to this person and say, this person was a father figure for me. Because that person imparted into them, not biological values, but moral and intellectual values, and help shape them and form them in that sense. You had a comment, Sister Johnny?
Yes, Brother Paul. I just wanted to say, I just found out about 3 days ago, this family that I knew, and there were 17 of them. Ooh. And it's so amazing because I thought all 17 of them was by the same mother, mm-hmm. because you could not tell that they was not the mother's children.
Wow.
They was the father. 7 of them was the father's children. 10 of them was the mother's children. He brought them into the family. But you would never be able to tell that they was not his kids. He treated all of them was the same. Everything that they did, they all did it the same. Everybody got the same rewards. And you would never hear them say that, you know, that's not my child. I never heard them say that, even though we grew up together. Mm-hmm. So it just shows, you know, how the father had the family maintained.
That's right. That father is more than, in these days, it's more evident than ever. That anyone can go ahead and get somebody pregnant. Okay, that's the easy part. All right, being a father is taking responsibility and taking ownership. I think, again, we touched on it. It's not someone who's just, it's all about what mine and my own, but being a coverer, a nurturer, a protector for those that need it. And I think that what your testimony there is completely on point with that concept. The last one I had here in terms of the Greek definition and amplification of the word father, pater, one who stands in a father's place and looks after another in a paternal way. So I think it was it you, your father. He was the father of the neighborhood. My wife's father was quite that way. That he was everyone's dad in the neighborhood. He's always wagon rides and building projects and got the whole. Matter of fact, when he was coming, when we got married, we did a lot of work on our house. We'd be building a deck or refurnishing whatever. And I'd come home from work and he'd be visiting and working on a project for us. And you have all the neighborhood kids in the house working on some kids I didn't even know. I've been there for 6 months, didn't know him. But as soon as my father gets there, he's got all these kids working on the house. He just had a way with kids. They just kind of were drawn to him. I'm going too fast? Okay, I'm sorry. I only got an hour. Let me slow down then. Okay, so let me keep moving here. What biblically speaking, we like to look at something called the law first mentioned, where when a term is used, you look where it's first applied because that usually sets the tone and the example for how that term will be applied elsewhere in the scripture and the writings. So the first time we have the word father mentioned in the Bible is in the Old Testament. And typically when I'm doing a word study of this nature, I want to look at an Old Testament reference, a gospel reference, and a New Testament reference just to get a full circular view of the concept. The first one's in Genesis 2:24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife and they shall be one flesh. So in this particular term, I mean, this is the historical, biological definition, how it's being applied. As we would think of Father today, that's how it's being applied. In the Gospels, we have Mark 1:20, and straightway he called them, and they left their father, Zebedee, in the ship with the hired servants and went after him. This is, I believe, Peter and James when Jesus first called them. James and John when Jesus just first called them. And so again, the way it's being applied here is the same way that we typically apply it. In the New Testament, the first use of the word father, pater, is in Acts 1:2. Until the day which he was taken up, after that he, through the Holy Ghost, had given commandments unto the apostles whom he had chosen, to whom also he showed himself alive after his passion by many infallible proofs, being seen of them 40 days, and speaking of the things pertaining to the kingdom of God. And being assembled together with them, commanded them that they should not depart from Jerusalem, but wait for the promise of the Father. Which saith he, ye have heard of me, for John truly baptized with water, but ye shall be baptized with the Holy Ghost not many days hence. So the first use of the word father in the New Testament, interesting enough, was not, under the New Covenant, was not a paternal, not a biological relationship, but speaking of our heavenly relationship, that it was a foreshadowing of the fact that these 120 that would be gathered in the upper room were to be the first ones to be born of the new birth, to be born from above, being born again, and entering into that spiritual relationship with God. He's not just the creator of heaven and earth and all the atoms and the molecules in the world, but he becomes the father of our newborn again spirits in this context. Any comments or questions so far? This is just me setting some background. We're going to get some more things here. Okay, I'll keep moving. So the next topic I want to get to on this point is, what is the purpose of fatherhood? So that's, I always like the way I do things again. I'm an engineer, and so by training, they teach engineers to ask questions, that it doesn't matter how smart you are and how good you are at getting the answer if you're answering the wrong question. If the question's not meaningful, then what, you've wasted time. So I always approach things with a question. What is the purpose of fatherhood? So anyone have a comment or thought on that? Why did God do it this way? I mean, he could have had it that babies grow in a field and they'd be, you know, like harvested. He had a reason for the family structure. He had a reason for, and again, the first mention of father in the Old Testament, the whole Bible, is, and a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. So God had this family structure in mind when he created man. Go ahead, Johnny.
I think God's purpose was because he wanted something to be like him.
There you go.
So that's why he made the man first, because God is the head of everybody. Mm-hmm. He made the man to be the head of the family.
Yes.
It's a structure. So God is about structure, and that's why he made the man, because he wanted someone to be like him, and then he wanted to have a family structure up under that, because he is the father of all.
That's right on, Sister Johnny. God could have done it many different ways, but we got to remember, he created man in his image, in his likeness. So there's something about when we look at the family relationships that he's ordained, that's husband and wife, that's father and son, or father and child. There's something in those relationships that he meant to reflect, to image, to illustrate something about himself. God is invisible. He's a spirit. We can't see him. And so he communicates to us and teaches us in ways that we can relate to. And the two that Sister Johnny is right on, the two relationships that God put men in specifically to represent and communicate a truth to all humanity, number one was as a husband, and number two as a father. As a husband, we're referred to as the bride of Christ. That there's a, and if you understand in Ephesians 5:22, I'm going to get to that a little later, where he talks about, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. Then he goes on to say, this is a great mystery, but I speak of Christ and the church.
Yes.
That the whole marriage, a relationship, was meant to be more than just a way of operating as human beings, a way of procreating, but it was meant to communicate something much deeper about the covenant relationship he planned for us later in Christ. And then also in John, we have, I think it's John chapter 3, it says, now are we the sons of God, yet it doth not appear what we shall be, right? That not only are men meant to illustrate and image the husband relationship, the role of the husband, which is God as our husband, as we the bride of Christ, but the role of a father. So I think it wasn't by accident that he set up the family structure the way he did. It could have gone in many, you know, multiple different ways, but there's something about that that's sacred and special. And that's why the family is so important to the kingdom of God. And that's why the family is under attack these days, that you have so many situations where homes are splintered, where the father and mother aren't together. And that's Satan's intent to undermine this covenant, this relationship, this model. When we don't have a good model of what a father is in a home, It undercuts, it inhibits, it sabotages our ability to really understand our Heavenly Father, right? And so you have many people who grow up without fathers who struggle with understanding a God's love for them, or people, if they're not in a healthy relationship, man and wife-wise, it can inhibit or, prohibit a healthy understanding of God's love as a husband to us. So I'll move on to the next point of the lesson here. What are the responsibilities of a father? So we talked about some of these already that, go back to what we said, loving, caring, protecting, having a heart for others, being fun, showing discipline with love, being a teacher, a trainer, and being fair. I think I heard that from the church here today. And that's well along the lines of the items I wanted to hit on. So as I was reflecting on this, as I was praying about this, this is what the Lord showed me in terms of the responsibilities of a father. And I'm going to walk through these here. First at a high level, then we'll dig in a little bit. So high level, I'm going to say the first responsibility of a father is as a husband. And again, if that's not the situation that you grew up in or that you're currently in, that this isn't a condemnation on you. I'm just talking about how God ideally had planned it to be. that the first thing that I owe my sons is to honor their mother. If I'm not doing that, then everything else is suspect. So to love, honor, and cherish my bride is my first responsibility as a father. My next responsibility as a father would be to train and to discipline. I think that was mentioned earlier also. The next one would be as a protector, as a provider, as a leader, and then the last one was maintaining my purity as an example to my sons and as a covenant keeper to my wife. So I think that's seven elements that I believe God laid on my heart in terms of the responsibilities of a father. And let's dig into these from the Bible and see what God has to say about these. All right, so the first one, love, honor, and cherish my bride. The word love in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, is translated as agapeo. And the first passage I want to bring up with regards to that is Ephesians 5:21. Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. That part right there, that's the call, the responsibility to husbands. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. I remember when I was first doing marriage counseling. This is now, it would be 12 years, and September would be 12 years. So with my former pastor who I grew up with, we did some marriage counseling with him. And one of the things he said, and he was always one that he liked to take a sideways view to a script. Whatever you thought the scripture meant, he was going to look at it a little bit different and give you a little bit different spin. And sometimes I thought, like, that's a little bit weird. I don't know if I can go with you on that. And then later as I reflected, I was like, oh, you know what? I see what he's saying now. And this was one of those. That he typically brings this emphasis up in every marriage ceremony he does. But in one of the ceremonies he did, and he also brought this up in counseling, is this very part that, where is it here? That he gave himself for the church. And there's another passage, I don't think I have it here, if I can keep going here, about laying down his life. That was the real emphasis, that Christ laid down his life for his bride. And he said, well, that doesn't mean that you're dying for your bride, that you're dying for the church. Oh, now I remember. It wasn't even talking about marriage specifically. He's talking about Christ specifically and then applied it to marriage. But the point he was making is it wasn't that Christ died for us. That was important that he did that. But before he died for us, he lived for us. You follow? That his death would not have been meaningful if he was not at all points tempted like as we are. If he was not obedient and subject to the will of the Spirit through his whole life. He maintained this life of perfection. So his whole life was a pouring out of his own wills, his own desires. As a man, he was tempted, right? There certainly had the eyes and attention of all the women of Judea, but that wasn't for him. He didn't take any particular glory or gain to himself. He didn't elevate himself and lord it over the people. He was a servant to all. So if he didn't live that way, his death wouldn't have meant anything. If at any point he had given into temptation or sin or pride or vanity, his blood would not have been a righteous sacrifice. So the point that the pastor was making is that he laid down his life first. It wasn't that he was willing to die. Yes, he was, but he laid down his life first. And that was the part he emphasized to us as husbands, that it's a laying down of your life is what God's calling us to do, to live not for yourself, but for your bride. That every decision, every activity, everything you do is done in the context of considering the impact and the benefit and the potential harm it does to your wife and children. That the role of a father is one that is to be completely selfless, if you follow what I'm saying. And that really struck me. And that's hard. Until you become a father, until you become a parent, and many of you, I mean, I'm speaking to mostly women, but as women, you can also relate as a parent that To raise a child is a complete denial of self, if you're going to do it right, right? There are people who aren't ideal parents who don't put their children first. But if you're going to do it right, if you're going to do it like God did it, laying down your life, it takes everything you have. But that's what God has called us to do. Next thing. So first thing I talked about is loving my wife and laying down my life for putting her needs above my own. The next is honor. So love, honor, and cherish. What does honor mean? We have that in a lot of the marriage vows. Love, honor, cherish, obey. Honor is one that's typically in a lot of the marriage vows. Anyone have a good definition? What does it mean to honor your spouse or your mate? Okay, that's a good one. Faithful. Yeah, faithfulness. Okay, that's exactly how the Strong's Concordance, one of the definitions that's applied. So definitely being faithful. That if you're not being faithful, you're not being respectful. I mean, so those go hand in hand. But the Strong's Concordance, the word for honor in the Greek is timē, which means to value by which the price is fixed. It means there's no negotiation. That once you've set the value of something, you're not going to back off and say, well, you know, I'm a compromise here, I'm a compromise there. That once you've set the value of your wife, your spouse, that you're going to honor them, there's no backing off on that. It means to have reverence for, to prefer the other, to have deference. It means preferring the other over yourself. No, baby, you had the last piece of chicken. I'm all right, I'm good, you know. You're gonna defer and prefer your mate. And in 1 Peter 3:5, I'll jump to 3:7 for speed here. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of grace, of life, that your prayers be not hindered. This is another one that you hear a lot in some of the marriage ceremonies, that the pastor will warn the husband that if you don't go and be trying to pursue God and pursue a relationship with God, if you're not going to treat his daughter correctly. And I mean, imagine that. Imagine me, and God sees everything you do, but imagine me going to my father-in-law's house and pursuing and asking him for something, want to buddy up with, hey, let's go do this, and he knows that I've disrespected his daughter. Right? That's not going to go so well. And so in the same way, God has called us to honor our brides and honor our wives. If we want to have a good relationship with him. So I've got a little testimony on this one, so I'm going to tell the truth today, as I like to do. So recently there's been an emphasis in my household on marriage. My wife and I have really been focusing on our marriage, because marriage is not going to stay healthy and vibrant on accident. Anything that you don't feed is going to die, right? If you take it for granted, it's going to die. And I can get guilty of getting so caught up in, I'm a person that really operates on duty and responsibility. If I've got a responsibility, if I've got a duty, that's what I'm all about. And it doesn't matter how I feel about it, I'm not emotional about it, I'm going to do what I need to do. And sometimes getting so focused on commitments for the kids and work and so on and so forth, I forget to water the flower, so to speak. And my wife will remind me from time to time. And so here in this last couple of months, we've really had an emphasis, a focus on making sure that we continue to water the garden. And we were in a nice, passionate discussion on the way home. I think we were coming back from some trip. Might have been coming back from here. Probably. And we're getting into it about this, that, and the other. And I was getting frustrated because, as I told you, I'm a person of duty and responsibility. Tell me what the rules are. Tell me what I got to do, and I'm going to do it. Don't tell me it'd be nice if you sometimes. No, tell me what you need, baby. I got you. Tell me what you need. And she's going through and she's starting to communicate her needs. And she's not one that can articulate exactly how she feels or what she wants. She feels a certain way, and you should know how she feels, Paul. You should know. And I was getting frustrated that baby, I thought I was doing what you said I needed to do. I did this, that, and you know, I thought that, is that not, that's not enough? That's not what you wanted? Well, no, I wish, you know, sometimes it'd be like this. I'm getting frustrated. And I thought the kids was asleep. And I said, baby, I was like, I'm not going to say it. But I told her in a not so loving way, that I thought she was not being fair to me. That's what I can say. Can I say crap at Rehoboth? Is that okay to say? I said, baby, you full of crap. I was like, that's crap, babe. I said it, so it's on Facebook. Sorry, Pastor, but I was like, baby, that's bull crap. You can't. That's not fair. You're not treating me fair, and this is not an anger. We're not yelling, but I'm just very expressing how I'm feeling, and we worked it out. You know, everything's good. We're still working through what exactly those needs are and how I fulfill them. But the next day, I'm come home from work, and. Let's see what happened. I'm just kind of getting some food together and stuff, and Isaiah walks up to me, and he says, Why did you say mommy's full of crap? And then Angie looks at me. She's like, yes, why did you say that? And I was like, because I thought you was asleep. I had no excuse for it. I'm confessing here, I'm testifying, that wasn't honoring my wife in that moment. That wasn't reverencing. That wasn't, obviously we're humans, we're going to disagree, we're going to have passionate discussions, but there's a way to disagree agreeably. There's a way to voice your position with respect and with honor, and I didn't do that in that moment. And this gets into a later part of what I'm going to talk about, is eyes are watching. Little eyes and little ears are watching and listening at all times. Even when you think they're asleep, they're picking up on what you're doing, on what you're saying. And so I had to apologize. I had to repent and say that what Daddy was wrong. Daddy shouldn't have done that. But I didn't honor her in that moment. So God's still working on me. Praise God. Thank God he's still working on me. So the next part is, I said, love, honor, and cherish. And you may say, well, aren't these all kind of the same thing? You love her, you honor her, you cherish. Yes and no. There's some overlap, but these words have different emphasis, different highlights, if you will. So the love speaks of overall commitment. You can say that love is more than an emotion. There are aspects where love is expressed emotionally. We're going through some, we're actually doing some marriage stuff at our church now. And they talked about the difference between they called it real love and in love. And I didn't like how they classified it because what it's doing to me is it's undermining the in love portion. If you have real love, you will be in love. There is an aspect of it. But they're trying to separate the emotional side and let's say the passionate side and then the commitment side. But from my experience, if you have real love, if you are, and what real love is, it's a commitment, it's a decision to value someone, to be committed to someone. And in doing that, part of that commitment of love, and this goes with your relationship with God, and I talk about, this leaks out in everything I teach, Matthew 6:21, that where a man's treasure is, there his heart will be also. If you understand that passage, it applies to every area of your life. It applies to your professional business. It applies to your relationships with your spouse or with others. It applies to any type of goals you have for fitness or nutrition. If you learn to treasure something, but with your thoughts, words, and actions, your heart will start to follow after it. And you'll get this momentum, this passion for something you didn't even think you liked. So I'm going to do a little detour here. I think I might have told this last time I spoke. But I learned this principle when I was taking social psychology in college. I have to think very slowly when I say it. My professor said, you don't give flowers to the girl you like. You like the girl you give flowers to. You don't give flowers to the girl you like. You like the girl you give flowers to. And we were all like, what's the difference? What's the difference? There's a big difference. Go ahead. That's a perspective on it, but let me tell you the root word and how it overlaps with Matthew 6:21, excuse me. All right, so what he was saying is that, well, let's go back to Matthew 6:21. What does it mean when he says that where a man's treasure is, there his heart will be also? What does that mean to everyone? Where a man's, he says this, he didn't say where a man's heart is, his treasure will be. He says where a man's treasure is, there his heart will be also. So he says treasure before heart. What does that mean?
I think it's a treasure is something that you value, or a treasure is something that is expensive, that is valuable, that you put stock in. And if you really value that thing, just like I wouldn't have somebody just come up to my car and scratch it or kick it, I would get very upset about that because it means a lot to me, and I value that.
But why does it mean a lot to you, right? It wasn't free. It was expensive. There was a commitment of resources for you to obtain that thing.
Right.
Right. So the point that Jesus is making, and I'll go back to my own, I'm sorry, did I cut you off, Mom?
No, you're fine.
The point I'm making is back in, let's say, 2000, maybe 9, I was really struggling with my faith. Right. In the Gospels, Jesus says, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy mind, all thy soul, all thy strength, all thy might. And it depends which gospel you're reading. It mixes up those four. And I said, well, what if you don't? what do you do? What if you don't feel like you love God? What if God, you know, you this didn't work out like you wanted, and that didn't happen, so you mad at God? You don't love God. It's when you think love's an emotion, when you think love's just a passionate thing, then you're stuck. You can't help how you feel in a given moment. You can't. You cannot help how you feel in the given moment. But God has given us a tool to reprogram our hearts. We can decide how, not in a moment, but wherever you are in a given moment, you can change how your heart feels by what you treasure. So let me talk about what treasuring is. So treasuring is your thoughts, words, and actions, anything that you put value on. So if you see somebody who might be a business person, that's always checking the stock market, always checking, looking at the price go up, price. Why is he doing that? Because he's got money in the stock market. I'm not checking the stock market. I got a mutual fund, but I'm not looking at it every day. Someone, I'm trying to think of something, we'll take it related back when you're a kid. Like, you get some brand new shoes or something. You walking around with your nice, clean, white shoes. I mean, you're very focused on, that's valuable to you. Anything that you invest your time, your money specifically, so this is another reason why it's so important to tithe and to pay offering. Not just for the practical reasons of supporting the church. That is a way of you programming your heart to value God. When you take this money that you worked for and you put it in the offering, your heart is sitting back and watching and say, why are we giving this hard money away to this church? Your heart says, well, this must be important. God must be valuable. God must be providing. If we know we got these bills and we're going to get us away, then God must be the one that's going to come through. It's training your heart to believe God, to trust God. And the more you treasure with your thoughts, words, and actions, and this gets back to the flowers, and I'll relate this to this, I'm going to run out of time. Is Pastor in here? How much time do I have? 25 minutes? 11:45, so I got 20 minutes, 5, 10, 15. Okay, I'm going to just hit the hot stuff and then I'll get out of here. This is an important one. Every time I speak, I can't help, this leaks out of me because it's such a fundamental truth. When I was in high school, I took a friend of mine to the prom. We was just friends. I was super superficial when I was young. I mean, you had to be like, perfect 10 or I wasn't even going to talk to you. I was like super, I'm just being honest with you. And she was not my ideal type of girl, but she was cool. She was my girl. We was cool. We hung out at school. Everything was great. And she asked me to take her to prom. We were good friends. I said, okay, yeah. And I said, you know what? This is my friend. I'm going to make this a special night. I'm going to do everything I can to just, there's a reason she asked me. She didn't have someone that she valued enough. She didn't have she wasn't in a romantic relationship at the time. So since she didn't have someone that could make it special for her in that way, I'm going to make it special as her friend. So I got the tux, got faded up nice. Borrowed Pop's LHS, had Brian McKnight in the deck, got the corsage and the flowers. I said, I'm going to treasure her tonight. Make it a special night for her. And she came out. She was cleaned up. She was cleaned up. And I'm like, okay, all right, cool. All right. I'm going to get the door for you. So all through this night, and my heart, and I don't have time to get into the details of how we're architected, but we are created as spirit, soul, and body. We're not just flesh and blood. We're not just spirit in terms of that which is descended from God. How can I say it? We're not just spiritual in the sense of one component. Within that part of us that is spiritual, there's a human side and there's a divine side, right? So animals also have spirits. You can read it in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, but they don't have, I'll say it, they have souls. They don't have what we would call spirit. The spirit that we have is the breath of God. We're the only creature in creation that has the spirit of God. You follow? But other creatures, they're physical and they also are spiritual. And that spiritual part of them is what's called the soul. So humans have a soul. We have a spirit. We have a body. Your soul is the spiritual part of you that's human. It's your thoughts. It's your will. It's your emotion. It's your memories. The things that help define your personality. That's you. And this is where I'm talking about when it says you can reprogram your heart. This is what I'm talking about. It's not your physical organ. I'm talking about this, the part of your soul that's your memories, your definitions. Okay, so where was I going with this? Okay, so as I was treasuring her throughout the day, treating her this way, by the end of the night, my heart's watching and saying, you know what? She must be special. She must be worth all this treasure. And I started to feel some type of way by the end of the night. I'm telling you, right? It wasn't that I went in planning to do that. Matter of fact, if you'd asked me that morning, hey, would you like to get with this girl? I'm like, no. But your heart doesn't care necessarily what you intend to do. It watches what you do. Right? You may say, I love God, and I do all this, that, and the other, but if you're not in his word, if you're not spending time in prayer, if you're not faithful in your finances, your heart's like, no, you don't love God. You're saying it, but that's not, you don't really love God. So your heart's paying attention. So getting back to the flowers, right? If you continue to give flowers to a girl, even if you don't like her, you bring her chocolates, you write her songs, you write her poems, eventually you won't help but fall in love with her. You'll start to fall in love with this person because you love them by your choice. You did these thoughts, words, and actions that were actions of love. And by doing that, you can convert and transform your heart to have an emotional, passionate draw towards that person. You can't help but give them flowers after that. You follow what I'm saying? It's the same in your relationship with God. It's the same in your relationship with your mate. Any marriage that's in trouble can be healed by treasuring the other person. By treasuring the person. That was free. I didn't mean to get into that. I'll keep on moving. Okay, so where was I at? Oh, so cherish. So the third part of love, honor, and cherish, and we just, like I said, there's been an emphasis in my marriage here lately. We've really been focusing on our marriage a lot more. Really been, if there's a conference, if there's a seminar, if there's a class, we're actually doing this book together called Strength-Based Marriages. That's been very illuminating for us. But there was a conference at our church here recently called Living Room Reset. I don't know if you guys remember Kirk Cameron from the 80s, Left Behind. Yeah. So he has a ministry now where he's going around to churches and he's doing this thing called Living Room Reset, where he just talks about elements of marriage and family and things like that. And he really was focused on this cherish piece. He's like, cherish, you know, what is cherish? And the part he brought up, and I'm not gonna read it, like he didn't read it because it's you'll see in a second, but he talked about, he said, what is cherish? And then he started reading some verses from the Song of Solomon. So you guys, if you read Song of Solomon, you understand where I'm going. That cherish is that celebrating, that intoxicated, that celebration of relationship. You read Song of Solomon, and my dearest, my heart breaks, and your body is this, and your mouth is that, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, he was so in depth and so in detail. He was like, your feet and your...
Yes. So he couldn't even read all the verses, but what it's saying is that cherishing is not just respecting, not just committing, but truly celebrating the other person, enjoying your fingernails, your whatever it is. Your neck is sexy. I love your neck. Whatever anything you can find, it's celebrating every single thing about it. But also, if you get into the actual root word of that, there's more to it. And also, another word definition for cherish, other than the celebration side, is in the, let's see, is this the Greek or the Hebrew? This is the Hebrew. Sakan, it's called in Hebrew. It means to be of beneficial service, to be a steward, to show harmony, to know intimately. So part of cherishing isn't just celebrating, but also serving, also looking for ways to add value, to build up, to... How can I say this? To invest in, to help that person grow. Not just be a part of enjoying life with them, but having them grow, having them become their best selves is part of cherishing. Okay, so that's the first part I talked about in terms of the roles. Again, we're talking about responsibilities of a father. And in that, it's really father, husband, man. I'm really kind of majoring on all those points. The next one I'm going to get into, any questions or comments on what I said there? I'll keep rolling. There's so much more I wanted to say, but I'm running out of time there. Let me move on to the next point. Training and discipline was one that was brought up here. So this is also one that God spoke to me about. Proverbs 22 and 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Ephesians 6 and 4. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And Colossians 3:21 also jumps on to the same thing. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. And then this one here in Psalms is one that you also will hear sometimes at baby dedications. Again, just reemphasizing. And I struggle with this myself sometimes. I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm a very, probably transparent to a fault person, but I'm going to read this verse and I'll speak about it a little bit. It says in Psalms 127 and 3, lo, children are an inheritance of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with enemies in the gate. So as a father, this is something I really struggle with sometimes. Again, I get so focused on duty, I get so focused on responsibility, so focused on planning and strategy. Okay, the finance situation, okay, what are we going to do? We're going to be 5 years from now. Are we going to get a new vehicle? Are we going to get a new house? What do we got to do here? What's going to be the schooling situation in a couple years? I'm always thinking ahead, always planning ahead, always trying to figure out how we get from A to B. And I can sometimes, and I told this to my brother at his wedding, I think in my best man speech. I said, Chris, don't get so focused on the destination that you miss the journey, that you don't enjoy the journey, right? I'm 37 now. Gosh, I'm 37. Like, some of y'all are older than me, like, this nothing. But for me, like, I feel like that happened, like, is they okay? That happened so quickly. Like, I've been at my current job now, it'll be 11 years. I feel like I just started like last year. Like this last 10, 11, 12 years has gone by so fast. And the reason is because I'm always looking ahead. I'm always trying to get somewhere that I'm not fully focused on the journey and not fully focused on appreciating the life that God has given me, the blessing of just relating to Him and experiencing everything He has for me each day, and the blessing of my children and my wife. This says right here, that the fruit of the womb is His reward. That my children are my reward, and yet sometimes they become a duty and a responsibility. And I'm regimented. And the way I have to be, in a sense, because I found that with all the responsibilities I have, if I don't be very regimented, something's going to get missed. So I have scheduled in playtime every night with my children. Because if I didn't, something else would come in and take the way. But the struggle, the challenge for me sometimes is I'm not able to enjoy it, because I'm thinking about all of my duties and responsibilities. And I want to encourage fathers, anyone, I know there's not a lot here today, but anyone that will hear this in the future, don't let the duties of life rob you of what should be your reward. What should be your reward? God gave us children as a blessing and as a responsibility, but also as a privilege and an honor that He's entrusted us to nurture souls up into the kingdom. With the father, the parent relationship is the strongest relationship of influence. I can go out and I can preach it at work. I can teach Bible school here. I can go help these kids in the neighborhood, so on and so forth. But the greatest influence I'm going to have on anyone is going to be my sons and my children. So I can't take that for granted. The other part that spoke to me is that children end up being a man's legacy. You know, people get so focused on their career and what's going to be the speech when they retire and so on and so forth. But the truest, the thing that's really going to go on and carry on the elements of Paul Brownlee that will live on past whenever I pass will be in my children. They will carry me forward, and they will be my influence, my footprint in the world moving forward. So I can't take that lightly. I can't neglect that. The next element of fatherhood I want to talk about was protection. And I got a couple things I'll comment on here. So the scripture that came to me in the context, this is not how it's applied, but Jesus was referring to a natural truth to make another spiritual point. In Matthew 12:29, after the context here is the Pharisees were accusing Jesus of casting out demons by the power of Satan. And Jesus said, wait a second, now, y'all talking crazy. That doesn't even make sense. You know, how could Satan fight against Satan? And he brought up this phrase here. He said, how else can a man enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, then he will spoil his house. Now, in this context, Jesus was saying that he was going to come into the devil's house and tie him up, right? But he was referring to the fact that a man should protect his house. A man should be there to stand up for his family. And that's the duty of a father, both physically, but I think the part that's neglected and the part that again, it's easy to take lightly is that more important than the physical protection is the spiritual protection. On the physical side, I remember when we were growing up, we went to a school that was somewhat rougher at times, and there were bullies on the bus, and they really liked to target my older brother. And I was trying to stand up for him. I'm more of my family. I'm more of the fighter, like everyone else. If my parents ever got a call that someone got in a fight at school, they wouldn't ask who it was. They would know it was me. It wasn't Chris. It wasn't Matthew. It was me. So I was the fighter, so to speak, in the family. And that wasn't Matthew's place. That was his approach. But they were on Matthew for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I don't remember how this happened, but Pops found out about it. I don't know if you remember this, Dad. So we came out to the bus stop like normal. And I don't know why, but he was carrying a screwdriver for some reason. I don't know if this was on purpose or if he just happened to be doing some time. But you ever see somebody that's like so mad that you don't even question, even though you know they're not supposed to be doing whatever they're doing, you ain't even going to say nothing to them? My dad walked on the school bus. You're not supposed to do that. The bus driver didn't say nothing to him. The bus driver was like, okay. So my dad got on the school bus, followed Matt back to wherever the seats and found whoever it was. And with the screwdriver in his hand, again, I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but he said, something, I better not have to come back on this bus again. and got up and walked out. And the bus driver was like, well, he better not have to come back. He was jumping. I was like, don't have that man come back on my bus again. Okay, y'all cut it out. The bus driver didn't fully know what was going on, but after that, he knew something happened. But a father protects. A father will stand up for his own. A father's there to provide that physical protection. On the other side, the spiritual side, a father has to be conscious and aware of what is coming into his home, not just on the physical side, but the spiritual side. What type of music do your kids hear you listen to? What kind of movies do your kids see you watch? What kind of conversations? Again, I was guilty, right? I told my wife something, and my son called me out on it. That kids, the eyes are open and the ears are listening. We have to be careful what we let into our home in terms of spiritual influences, because those things will be passed forward. I heard it said in a it's credited to Bruce Lee. I don't know if this is true or if it was a fictional embellishment of his movie. But this movie called is a Bruce Lee movie called The Last Dragon. It's a biopic, not The Last Dragon, The Bruce Lee Story. I really liked this movie when I was younger. It related to me. But in this movie, Bruce Lee's father deal with fear and anxiety. He'd have panic attacks. And they used this panic attack anxiety theme, and they had a metaphor for that as if it was a demon, if it was a spiritual force, which it very well could have been, for all I know. And the point that was made in the movie is that if a man doesn't conquer his demons, he will pass them on to his children to fight. And so let it not be said that I pick up any baggage, anything that I would pass on to my children, that anything that would come against our home, as a father, I need to be willing to stand up against it spiritually first. Physically, well, that's second, but spiritually first to fight against those things. And I definitely had that in my father. I have no idea a lot of the turmoil that they may have gone through financially or who knows what else, because that stuff never got to me. I never looked and saw my dad fearful or out of sorts or yelling at my mom or doing anything like that. He set an example, and he was a protection over our household. That stuff never got to me. Maybe one of these days we'll have a conversation on some of the real. I used to complain and say, okay, why can't we get McDonald's this week? Because money might have been tight. But I didn't know really what was going on. They protected us from that. I never went with it. Matter of fact, I was pretty fat when I was young, so I could never be accused of missing meals. So I ate okay. They always did that, which moves into my next point. I'm running out of time here. Provision. We already talked about this. It's obvious in 1 Timothy 5:8. It says, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. The specific context here was actually in regard to widows, that you had situations in some of the New Testament churches where a man's father would die and he wouldn't step up and take care of his mother, which is just despicable. And he's calling him out on that. In Thessalonians 3:10, it says, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. So all these things are pretty obvious. It goes without saying that a man should always provide for his home. Now, if a man's physically unable, there's other ways to provide that don't involve necessarily working outside of home. But it's a bringing of oneself to the table to provide and take care of the family. I'll keep moving here. I'm running out of time. Leadership. 1 Timothy 3:4 says, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? That God's called fathers to be leaders in the home. To be leaders in the home first. Don't go out and try and build your kingdom outside of the home. Build the kingdom in the home first. Matthew 20:26. The other aspect of leadership is servanthood. The context for this one is you had some of the disciples arguing about who would be greatest in the kingdom. And Jesus said, no. You don't understand what being great really means. He says, but it shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. The word in the Greek is diakonos, which means servant. That people look at the pulpit, look at the ministry, so to speak, as some lofty, flashy, celebrity type of status. But really what it means is you've just made yourself a greater servant if you're in the ministry form. We're all ministers in our lives, wherever we are. But to be in the ministry, formally speaking, is just to be a greater servant, to be accountable to more people, to be subject to more people. That he must first be last and must serve. And Jesus demonstrated that, right? We had God manifest in the flesh, washing the dirt off of people's feet. There's no greater example of servanthood than that. Lastly, I'm going to get to here, and I'm going to have to shut it down. I've got 2 minutes. Fathers are called to demonstrate and manifest purity. We talked about, I think it was Eustace that mentioned that part of honoring and respecting is being faithful. And that's just not being faithful in terms of the actual formal act of stepping out on your wife, but faithful with your emotions, faithful with your eyes. They talk about what they call emotional affairs that happen at work, which is where it starts. It starts first with emotion, and the physical follows. The physical always follows the spiritual, by the way. That you never... David didn't accidentally end up in bed with Bathsheba just by accident. There was some emotional trajectory he was already on before he physically acted that out. It wasn't by accident he happened to be walking on the rooftops in the evening. It's well known that that's when people bathe, because they put the wash baths in the sun all day to heat up, and they bathe in the evening. So David was being kind of creepy at this time anyway. It didn't just accidentally, it was a series of events that he kind of fell into that. So first thing is a father needs to model purity emotionally with his eyes, with his ears, with his words, and everything he does. He should be modeling purity in his covenant with his wife and as an example to his sons. Matthew 6:21 says, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. This goes right with the saying. It says, the light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. It's so critical, especially for men, what we place before our eyes. You know, what we see, those things write images on your heart. Every experience you have, everything you visualize, you may think, oh, I just saw this movie and, you know, we just skipped through this part. No, anytime you're exposed to something, it's imprinting on you some way. So fathers need to be very careful, and especially with their son. Oh, I'm going to take my son to see this movie and we'll just bond. I know I'll tell him afterwards that this isn't okay. No. It's already in. That image has already gotten into their heart. So we got to be very careful about that. Here, I'm almost done. Ooh, I'm not almost done, but I'm going to be done. So I'll talk about a few things that I've learned as a father. And it's really, huh? Okay, I'm finished. It's really just a recapping of some things I've already, what I've shared to you. When I speak, I'm not just looking up stuff to teach you guys. I'm trying to share with what God has already lived out in my life. So what I'm going to recap here is the things that, as I was writing this formally, it's like, yes, this is what God has already shown me through being a father. First thing I've learned, that leadership is service. That to be the leader of a home is to be responsible. At work, I'm in a position of quite high prominence on a technical team. I've got, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 engineers working for me. And it feels like, people may look, I remember coming in, like, seeing the position I'm in now and thinking, oh, this is the greatest role. You the man, you the boss, you got it. Man, it ain't like that at all. So I remember coming into Whirlpool. I work at Whirlpool Corporation back in 2007, and I would see a Dean Pepple, I would see a Pierre Crevier, and I say, these guys are bosses. They walk into the room, everybody's watching, salute. Now, that's me. I'm gonna be honest, I got that. And I get here, and I'm like, man, this isn't what I thought it was gonna be. I'm responsible for everything. If it doesn't work, I have to go help them do it. Like, I can't just say, get this done and walk away. I got to say, what's stopping you? What's your problem? How do I help you? And I'm in. So everyone's problem is now my problem. So as a leader professionally, that's been a very illuminating thing. And then also in the home, I can't say, well, wife, you figure it out. I'm going to play basketball. No. I'm ultimately responsible. Whatever happens, I'm responsible. So leadership is service. Leadership is wiping diapers. It's cleaning up toilets. It's being vomited on. It's service, but it's rewarding. Children are a reward. Leadership is selflessness. It's preferring the other person. Another thing, as a child, I remember being little, like, man, I can't wait to be in charge and I have to do what he say. He always making me do stuff. When you become a father, you've become really a, you're not in charge of your life, so to speak, right? There's so many things that I want to do, I'd like to do, I can't do. It's not going to happen because I've got responsibilities. I am a servant to my children. So it requires selflessness. I can't just go on vacation anytime I want to go on vacation. Matter of fact, it takes a strategic amount of planning to even arrange for just to get a date night, to try and get some time away, because I'm not just going to put my kids with anybody, right? They're not just going to get dropped off X, Y, Z so I can go here. I'll make sure that they're taken care of first before I take care of myself. Other thing I've learned, a friend of mine told me this just recently. I'm over time, almost done. And maybe I'm sure everybody would disagree, but people have told me that I can come across as arrogant, as a know-it-all, as one who does not listen to others' input. And I rebuke that. I don't feel that that's me, but I've heard it from more than one place, so I have to be humble and continue to look for opportunities to improve. But one thing going into fatherhood, I was so certain. There's this whole historical dichotomy about nature versus nurture. How do you become who you are? Is it you're just born a certain way, or is it your experiences and your environment that shape you? And I was like, okay, nurture's like 90%. So if a kid's bad, their parents is bad. It's their fault. That it's all about what you do. But what I found is that nature is stronger than I thought. And my evidence for this is my two sons. My first son, Isaiah, is so cerebral, so intellectual, so thoughtful. He asks me questions that I'm shocked. I don't even know what to say to him sometimes. You know, he's me squared, tripled. Like, he says stuff that I can't even believe. And then my other son is just a complete Viking. Like, he just come in, he just bam, he just kicking stuff. He's like a shoot first, ask questions later, and then shoot again, like, type of guy. Like, he don't, and 95% of their experiences have been the same. We did everything as close to possibly the same as we did between the two, but there's a nature, there's a part of us that's innate, that comes from God, and there's a purpose for that. There's a reason Isaiah's the way he is, and there's a reason that Anderson's the way he is. Matter of fact, before Anderson was born, God gave me his name. His name, Anderson, means manly son. He is a manly son. Like, he's a man, right? So I know that God has something he's doing with that. He may be doing something with me to train me to have patience and grace, because he is trying every inch of me. But I've learned that God has given each of us a nature, and don't resist that nature. Again, I'm not talking about sinful things. Don't get that twisted. I'm not talking about I was born this way. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about there's an aspect of your personality, of your strengths that's uniquely you, that God is giving you for a purpose. Don't resist that. And fathers, don't try and reform that. Understand what the gifts and talents of your children are, and nourish those things. Don't try and make A like B. No, A is a good A, and B is a good B. Don't try, A will make a bad B, so to speak. Don't do that. And last thing I'll say is that I've learned from Father, and I'll have to stop here because I'm over time, is that understanding a father's heart and a father's love, it's really hard to appreciate until you get there. As a son, as growing up, you hear, like, God's a good God, he's a good father, he loves you, blah, blah. But until you understand what it's like to have an offspring that's done nothing positive for you, they're not paying you no rent, they ain't doing anything. They're not doing anything that's driving value to you personally. But the fact that they're yours means everything. The fact that's my son, those are my sons. Doesn't matter if they poop on the floor, if they do the same thing for the 59th time, I just told you not to do that and you just did it again. It doesn't matter. Yes, there's correction and there's discipline. There's training that goes with that. But it doesn't. Not one second I'm ever saying, do I still love this kid? Like, I've never thought that. And what I've come to understand is that's how God sees us in our mess, in our mistakes, in our shortcomings. God's never said, well, I might need my blood back. Are you not worth my? No. once you are his, once you're his son, once you're his child, that's daddy's boy. That's daddy's girl. And I don't have time to elaborate that further. I'm going to stop here. But I hope what I've shared has meant something to you. I appreciate the honor and the privilege my father's given me to speak here today. If I could leave one last thought with you, I'll leave one last thought with you. I heard a message here recently on grace, and I've really studied grace heavily since probably 2012. God gave me this revelation on grace that just blew my mind. But I still see little amplifications and aspects of it that just still touch me to this day. Many of you have probably heard of, you've probably seen it on TV, but there's this father and this son. And this father runs these triathlons. That means that he runs 100 miles, bikes whatever miles, swims whatever miles. And there, you know, lots of people do that. I think anybody who does that is crazy. Like, that's, there's no way I would do that. But this guy, he does these crazy feats of endurance, and he brings his son with him. So when he's biking, he's got his son in a basket, and he's riding the bike, a 100-mile bike race with a son in a basket. When he's swimming, he's got a raft with his son's in the raft, and he's towing his son. He's got like a leash, and he's swimming. It's like 2-3 miles. I couldn't swim 30 feet with somebody behind me. But he's pulling his son. And then lastly, when he's running, he's got his son like in a stroller. And the reason he did this is his son has, I think it's cerebral palsy. I don't know, has any of you seen this? You guys heard of this guy? Cerebral palsy. And this all started was that there was some type of fundraiser they were doing at his school, like a 5K or something like that, where you could raise money. And his son really wanted to participate and raise money for this cause, but he couldn't run, obviously. So he said, "Dad, you know, could you help me? Would you run this thing with me? So I could be, you know, I get sponsors, I can raise money, I can contribute." So that's the first time he did it. He got in a stroller and his dad pushed him. And at the end of this, you know, the dad just saw the look on his son's face, and his son was able to communicate to him. He said, "That's the first time that I didn't feel crippled, that I didn't feel disabled." And that touched this father so much that he wanted to give that experience to his son as much as he could. Now, I think to this date, they've done like 200 some marathons. But here's the thing, that really challenged me as a father, right? I get so caught up on what's essential, what's needed, but this man, he doesn't have to do this. His son's not going to suffer for not doing it. But just understanding that the sacrifice that this father's making is bringing this delight to his son, he's willing to do it. He's willing to do it. So the way this translates to me and the way this pastor brought about, he's like, when I saw this video and saw this, he's like, that's me. I'm crippled, I'm broken, yet God carries me. Yet God carries me on the bike. Yet God pushes me. God pulls me along when I'm weak. And what went further to me is not just that he does that, right? Because any father, you know, would, just having a son that's disabled, it's going to be somewhat of a burden on a father. You're going to have to feed him and bathe him and all. That's essential, right? You got it. If you're a man, you better do that. That's your son. But this other stuff, 100-mile biking and all this just to make him smile, that challenged me. Would I, as a father, be willing to just do something for my son's delight? But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. With his stripes we are healed. He was punished that we could have... He died to atone for our sin, right? He could have just... I thought this to myself one day. I was like, why didn't he just get, you know, his head chopped off like John the Baptist? His blood would have been spilled. We'd still be redeemed. What's all this beating and all this torture stuff for? Why did he do it? Why did he go to this extra mile for redeem us. Got it. Get your head cut off. Let it be done. But no. He said, I want them to have the best. I want them to have the best. I want them to have not just redemption of their spirit, but healing for their body, peace for their mind. He was willing to go above and beyond just for the delight of it. Now, he didn't need to do it. He could still redeem us shedding his blood some other way. But to give, to delight, he, for our delight, because he's so passionate towards us, because he's such a good, good father, he's willing to do whatever it took to be subjected to the worst kind of humiliation and torment we could imagine for our delight. That's a good father. That's a good father. I'm done.